Nud shook his head slowly. I'm not even sure I want to tell myself.
You're one of Crown Prince Dari's bastards.
A wide grin spread across Nud's face.
If only, he said. I don't think he had any.
Nud waved toward Einan and Furcher.
Looks like they're almost done. You'd better finish your touch-up work with glue and magestone fragments before Furcher gets back.
Right, said Merry. Later.
Nud watched her ascend and went back to rubbing Rocky's jaw. The big wyvern rumbled his contentment. Nud wished he could share the feeling. Chapter 59 Haydn. Duke Haydn had managed to sleep for a few hours before an aide woke him up near dawn. He dressed in his gambeson. The padded garment that went under his armour would be sufficient until it was time to don his full kit. It was a cool and foggy morning, with frost just beginning to melt off the grass between the pavilions. He saw a lamp was burning inside the young king's tent, and expected that Daria was feeling the full weight of his crown as the royal army prepared to take the field in a few hours. Several soldiers were up and about. The Duke stopped at a nearby campfire to encourage them and wish them well. Morale was critically important for an army, and this one hadn't been tested, except for skirmishes with clan leaders on the western borders and occasional disputes with Tamlock's garrisons at the forts near the Great Falls to the northwest. Haydn was pleased that the soldiers seemed confident and ready to fight for crown and kingdom. Dario's false reputation as a petulant and juvenile womanizer didn't seem to affect his standing with the troops. The Duke wished he felt as confident about his own performance as the soldiers seemed about the fight ahead. He reviewed the disposition of his troops for the upcoming battle. His heavy cavalry, knights in service to nobles and the crown, would be in the centre, surrounded by his most experienced infantry. Lighter troops with longbows and crossbows would be positioned behind the massed infantry, while less experienced local levies, supported by light cavalry, would make up the army's left and right flanks. He planned to have a contingent of wizards stay near the king and the army's commanders near the van, while other wizards would fly above the army, ready to attack or defend as necessary.
"Are we going to smash him, Your Grace?"
asked a well-muscled woman, sharpening a sword.
"That's the general idea," said the Duke.
"Is it true there are Roma legions on the east bank? Are they with us or with Tamlock?"
asked a man with a scarred nose. He was eating cooked oats from a small bowl. Behind him, a third soldier was stirring something, probably oats, in an iron pot with a long wooden spoon. Duke Haydn laughed.
"You'll just have to count on me knowing how to give us every possible advantage," he said.
He rubbed his padded arm and smiled, then raised an eyebrow.
"I've got a few tricks up my sleeve to make Tamlock's troops miserable."
"I'll bet you do,"
said the well-muscled woman, putting extra effort into the strokes of her oiled whetstone.
"I hear the young king will be fighting with us," said the man with the scarred nose.
"I'm trying to keep him from being the first to hit Tamlock's shield wall," said Duke Haydn.
"You're a wise man," said the well-muscled woman. "It wouldn't do for the kingdom to lose its king in the first 5 minutes of battle."
"Especially without a designated heir," added Scarnose.
"I'll call for you if King Dario proves to be too stubborn for his own good," said the Duke.
"Did I hear my name?" came a familiar voice.
Duke Haydn saw King Dario and the Duke's dark-haired oldest daughter, Jennet, standing behind the soldiers at the campfire.
"Your Majesty," said the scarred-nosed man without rising.
He held up his bowl.
"Would you and the lady care for some oatmeal?"
The king and Jennet were wearing thick robes over long nightshirts. Both looked tousled, which earned them smiles from the soldiers. Dario offered a small earthenware crock to the man with the scarred nose.
"Oatmeal sounds good," said the king.
"It'll be even better with this honey," said the soldier, accepting the crock. "Some for you too, my lady."
"I'd appreciate it," said Jennet. "So long as my father remembers to eat breakfast as well."
"Your father, my lady?" asked Scardnose.
"She means me," said Duke Haydn.
He reached into his pouch and removed a small bag of raisins, which he offered to Scardnose.
"These should help you stretch your breakfast."
"Don't be a fool and lead the first charge, Your Majesty," said the well-muscled woman. "Wait for the second or third engagement."
"That's good advice," Dario replied.
"And you may want to wait until you put on your armor," added Scarred Nose.
Jennet laughed and bowed to the soldiers, flashing a smile at each of them.
"With the two of you to advise our king,
The kingdom is in good hands, she said, then turned to Dario. If the king is wise enough to listen...
I'll listen better after I've dressed and had breakfast, said Dario.
Did someone mention breakfast? Said Damon, as the old wizard came into the firelight.
He was wearing a long nightshirt like Dario's. In fact, it was one of Dario's, borrowed from the king's supply of extra garments. He didn't wear a robe, and his body seemed to glow from the heat field he'd placed around him. The soldier, stirring the pot, filled four bowls with cooked oats and handed them to Dario, Jennet, Damon, and the Duke. Scarred Nose came by to add raisins and honey to each bowl. The well-muscled woman put her sword down on a rock and distributed spoons to the newcomers. After that was done, she found 4 2-foot lengths of tree trunk and placed them near the fire for the visitors to sit on. Dario turned to Damon.
I'm glad you're up. You need to be in position by the river before dawn. Wear that fancy robe if you can. It's impressive.
Good morning to you too, your majesty, said Damon. I know my job. Don't teach your grandmother how to bake pies.
Dario was about to offer a sharp reply, but Jennet touched his arm, and he spooned up sweetened oatmeal instead. I don't think my grandmother ever baked a pie, mused the young king. Neither did my great-grandmother.
I can bake pies, offered Jennet, both fruit pies and meat pies.
Wait until you try the chicken and egg pies from the Dormant Dragon Inn, said Dario. You'll have to get the recipe.
I'll put that on my to-do list, said Jennet. Maybe I'll wait until after today's battle?
Probably wise, said Dario. Duke Haydn covered his mouth with his hand and coughed softly to hide a smile. Dario was clearly nervous about what was to come and seizing on trivial matters to distract himself. Somehow, he'd thought his daughter would provide quite a bit of distraction on her own. Thinking of his daughter reminded him to ensure 3 or 4 wizards were tasked with protecting his daughter and others who'd be left behind in the encampment when the army mustered on the open field to the north. He ate some cooked oats and realized they were quite tasty, and that he was hungry.
"You'll work with Damon?" the Duke asked Dario. "I have to talk to my unit commanders."
"We'll head for the river as soon as I finish my oats and get dressed," said the king.
"And as soon as I'm ready," said Damon. "It'll take me a few minutes to get into my Master Mage's robes."
"May I assist you?" asked Jennet.
"If you'd like," said Damon.
He put his spoon in his empty bowl and placed both on top of his length of tree trunk after he stood. He began to walk away, and Jennet quickly rose to follow.
"Now who will help me get dressed?" protested Dario with a smile.
The well-muscled soldier got up, put her sword in its sheath, and loomed over the young king.
"I'll help," she said. "Maybe I can give you more good advice while I do."
Chapter 60 Einan.
"Is it working?" asked Mary.
"I can't tell," said Einan. "All I can see on the other side is a white mist."
"Did you consider that it might be foggy along the Brennaven?" asked Fircher. "I know that gate is working properly. Once you've made enough gates, you can feel it when everything is congruent."
"Maybe I'll be able to tell when I'm as old as you are," said Mary.
"Whatever happened to respectful apprentices?" Fircher mused.
Mary stuck her tongue out at Fircher and grinned. Her mentor copied Mary's gesture. Both laughed. Taking another look at the wide gate, Mary could tell that Einan was right about the scene on the other side of the gate looking like so much mist or fog. It roiled about beyond the interface like low-flying clouds. Chi was sleeping on the padded saddle in the middle of Rocky's back, while the big black wyvern was stamping back and forth, sniffing the air as if sensing prey nearby. Nud was keeping pace with Rocky's movements, speaking soothing syllables to help the wyvern remain calm.
"Who's a good boy?" asked Nud. "You're a good boy," he answered.
Fletcher glanced at Einan, shook her head, then walked through the gate and disappeared into the white mist.
"Did I do something wrong?" asked Einan. "I think you did the absolute minimum necessary," said Mary. "You should have called out. Dothan is supposed to be on the other side." "I didn't want to shout, because I was afraid my voice would carry and Tamlock wizards or soldiers might hear me," said Einan.
"That was wise," said Mary.
"When do you think Fircher will be back?" asked Nud. "She's the only one who knows how to rebuild the gate if anything happens at this end."
"I might be able to do it," said Mary. "I was watching her closely when she triggered the connection."
So long as you don't end up sending us into the middle of the harbour at Ryas, teased Nerd.
I'd be more likely to drop us in the Rithro, Mary noted. But since the gate is already established, the odds are good I get us back where Fircher made the original connection.
Good to know, said Einan. I hope Fircher will teach me how to set up gates too.
What did Dothan ask you? Said Mary. You were talking to him for a long time.
He's concerned about Daemon, Einan replied. He thinks it would be a good idea for me to be there when he freezes the Brenhaven.
Have you ever frozen anything? Asked Mary.
He froze a field of mud pots tonight to prevent 100 basilisks from attacking us simultaneously, said Nerd.
So you know the general concept? Asked Mary. All my blue mage stone does, said Einan. Your red mage stone is pulsing, said Mary.
She pulled Einan's red and gold artifact out from under his jacket and linen shirt. Einan could see crimson light flash across her face in time to his heartbeat.
What does it mean? Einan asked.
My guess is it's telling you it's full of heat energy, said Nerd. Daemons would do that when he taught apprentices how to freeze water. You'll want to figure out a way to release it soon.
Maybe shoot a fireball at the far end of the valley, suggested Mary. It would help with your surprise.
I'll have to wait a bit then, said Einan. It's still at least an hour before the sun's all the way up back east, even if there were hints of light when I stepped through into the fog.
You'll need to leave now, said Fircher to Einan, as she stepped across the interface.
Four wizards, Mary remembered from the Conclave's headquarters, were behind Fircher. The two men and two women all had solid sky-blue robes.
But I need to, began Einan. You need to help Daemon, said Fircher.
She moved behind Einan and began to push him toward the wide gate. He resisted and turned to face her.
Where do I go when I get there? Asked Einan.
Dothan will give you directions, said Fircher. But it's simple. Just head east until you get to the river, then look for Daemon's sparkling robes.
That should be easy, Einan replied.
Those robes would be visible from halfway to the moon.
Just get going, Fircher insisted. Daemon's planning to start as soon as a sliver of sun shows above the horizon. You don't have time to waste.
Will you and Rocky be ready?
Einan asked Nerd. Gee, raised his head from the saddle on Rocky's back, then lowered his head and went back to sleep.
We'll be fine, won't we, big guy? Said Nud to Rocky.
The wyvern licked Nud's face with his long forked tongue.
Good boy, said Nud.
Rocky rubbed his head against Nud's outstretched palms.
Go, said Mary. Fircher and I can help get things moving at this end.
You'll have to do that on your own, with help from these fine wizards, said Fircher,
indicating the men and women in wizard's robes who'd crossed over with her.
I'd use lightning, not fireballs, by the way.
Where will you be?
Asked Mary. Dothan asked for my help too, said Fircher. With luck, we'll surprise Vero before he can surprise us. Safe travels, said Nud. Watch out for Tamlock wizards on flying discs guarding their army, Einan.
I will, said Einan.
He blew Mary a kiss and stepped through the gate before Fircher could push him through. It was still foggy on the other side. He reduced the glow of the sphere above his head to the equivalent of a single candle.
Hello?
He whispered. Fircher took Einan's elbow and tugged him to the right, away from the front of the wide gate.
Dothan, she asked. In Thera?
Over here, said Dothan to Fircher.
Einan, you're here. Head east as fast as you can. Look for Daemon's sparkling robes. I know, said Einan. I'll find him.
Good, said Dothan. Be ready to help, but only if he needs it.
I'll do what I can, said Einan.
But I don't understand what Daemon would need my help with.
He's an old man, lad. A lot older than I am. And he hasn't worked this level of magic since before you were born, said Dothan. Lend him strength, Einan, but only if he needs it.
I'll try my best, said Einan.
But who will tell Mary when Tamlock's army is in place on this side of the gate?
I will, said Inthira. Five of us will stay here and let her know.
Good, said Einan.
He didn't want anything to interfere with the successful execution of his plan. Dothan spoke up and interrupted Einan's review of the things that could still go wrong.
Climb to 30 or 40 feet and head east until you hear the river, said Dothan. Daemon will be nearby. If you see legionnaires, you've gone too far, said Fircher with a smile.
How much of the river will Daemon try to freeze? Einan asked.
From shore to shore, and 200 feet along the banks, Dothan replied.
How deep? Asked Einan.
2 or 3 feet should be enough, said Fercher. More would be better if you can manage it.
Me?
Asked Einan. The only thing I've ever frozen is mud.
It's the same thing, said Fercher.
Not exactly, said Dothan, rubbing his chin. The solids in the mud vary its properties when you lower its temperature, so it's actually harder to freeze mud than water.
Whatever, said Fercher. Just go. Help Daemon. We have to head south to thwart Vero.
Vero's attacking from the south, asked Einan.
Not your problem, said Fercher. Help Daemon.
On my way, said Einan, climbing on his flying disc. The others mounted theirs as well. As he sped toward the river, Einan looked over his shoulder and saw the glowing balls above Dothan and Fercher's heads fade into the mist to the south. With a smile, he realized he'd be able to see his surprise play out from this side of the gate once Daemon worked his wizardry.
Chapter 61 Tuathal. Tuathal was dressed in an impressive green robe trimmed with gold. It was covered with hundreds of rounded quatrefoils, stylized clovers picked out in gold thread. The robe had long, deep sleeves with slits where he could slide his arms out. That made it easier for him to eat and sign documents without dragging his robe's fancy sleeves through sauces or ink. The king's undertunic was dyed a rich gold, and the buttons holding the tight sleeves of that garment closed were enameled green quatrefoils that matched his robe. It wasn't something to wear under armor. Tuathal had knights and soldiers to do his fighting for him. He stood in an otherwise open section of the headquarters tent beside one end of a trestle table set with 10 places. Thibaut and Tanis were transferring platters with dried fruit, rolls and sausages to the table from a small wheeled cart. Salda had arranged for the staff of the Blue Whale Inn to cater to Tuathal's every culinary need, ensuring that the king was well fed while in the field. If that meant more ears to overhear Tuathal's plotting, so much the better. A few minutes later, Salda himself arrived, escorting a now less bedraggled Princess Gwynedd. Tuathal gestured that Salda should seat her on a folding chair with curved arms at the opposite end of the table. The king knew the chair wasn't particularly comfortable, especially without the pillow that was on the chair beside him. Gwynedd sat glaring at Tuathal. She understood the game he was playing, or thought she did. Salda moved to assist Thibaut and Tanis by finding a gold-plated pitcher and pouring cider into mugs at each of the 10 places.
"Did you sleep well, my dear?" asked Tuathal with a slight sneer.
"Like a babe," said Gwynedd, offering an insincere smile. "I hope you can't say the same."
"Sheathe your claws, little kitten," said Tuathal. "There are other ears to hear."
"A prisoner should strike whatever blow she can to gain her freedom, wouldn't you say?" offered Gwynedd.
"But an honoured noble guest should mind her manners," countered the king.
Their exchange was interrupted by Irsa, the dark-haired young wizard entering the tent. She bowed to Tuathal.
"Your commanders await your pleasure outside, sire," she said.
"Send them in," said the king. "Then check my breakfast for poisons. Pay particularly attention to anything at her end of the table," he said, nodding toward Gwynedd.
The princess gave the young wizard a saccharine smile and lifted her hands above the table, palms up. Ursa didn't meet Gwynedd's eyes, but noticed the heavy rings she wore on both hands. Ursa stepped out of the headquarters tent momentarily, then returned with 8 hard-looking men and women wearing gambesons or archer's leathers, with Duke Nealon, the senior-most commander, in the lead. The duke passed much closer to her than necessary. Ursa felt his hot breath on her bare neck. She held in a shudder and stepped farther away until she stood behind the king while the rest of the commanders found their places. When everyone was seated, Ursa used her wizardry to carefully scan the table for poisons, paying particular attention to Gwynedd's rings. There was no telltale glow to Ursa's magic-augmented sight.
"Enjoy your meal, good gentles," said Ursa, giving her assent to proceed.
"Took you long enough to complete your scan," muttered Tuathal to Ursa when she finished. "Don't bother with a privacy sphere," said the king. "There's not much Darren can do to stop me now, anyway."
Ursa said nothing.
She just withdrew to stand near Salda, Dibbo and Tanis, where she could inspect any new food or drink before it reached the table. She was privately amused by Tuathal saying, "Stop me now," rather than "Stop us now," even with the leaders of his army arrayed before him. Her loyalty was to Vero, not to his older brother. Tuathal was not a man to inspire such feelings. Without waiting for Tuathal to start, Princess Gwynedd plucked a dried peach from a platter and nibbled it suggestively, trying to keep and hold eye contact with the king as she did. Tuathal ignored her. Instead, he speared a sausage with his eating dagger and took a roll from a platter. He spread butter on the roll and watched the others at the table break their fasts. Dawn wasn't far off, and this would be his last chance to confirm the military side of his long campaign was ready. The commanders reassured Tuathal that their forces were prepared for battle and knew the roles they must play. The king smiled as each reported. Tuathal's expression held just enough malice to ensure the men and women around the table wouldn't dare to disappoint him.
"Return to your troops," said Tuathal, once the last commander finished. "You know where to muster. Do your part, and we will crush Daran on the field of battle. Today is the day we unite north and south by the sword. Tamloch and victory." "Tamloch and victory," said the commanders, raising their goblets and saluting their king. Tuathal gave Duke Nealon and his other less senior commanders a malice-free smile as they departed. Once they'd left the tent, he reflected that Vero's report given a few hours earlier was the most important one. The southern clanlander barbarians attacking Daran's army from behind would truly turn the tide. He hoped his brother would get him word from the blasted Bifalander soon. They were the only detail he hadn't fully confirmed. He'd have to trust them to hold firm to their allegiance from noon on one day to dawn on the next. Still, Tuathal felt uneasy. Trust was not something he extended often. While he waited for word, he decided to amuse and distract himself with the princess.
"Would you like a good seat for the battle?" he asked. "You can sit by my side on the viewing platform I've erected."
Princess Gwynedd raised an eyebrow at Tuathal's choice of words and bit into a sausage, chewing sensuously before she licked her lips and swallowed.
"Do you intend to show off your captive?" she asked.
"I intend to remind Daria that I'm holding you, while having my future queen next to me as all my plans are realized," Tuathal answered.
"I suppose we both can gloat at Daran's loss and our gain," said the princess.
She licked grease off her lips and looked suddenly thoughtful.
"What?" asked Tuathal.
"How do you expect to ensure our son isn't killed or injured?" asked Princess Gwynedd,
all misguided attempts at seduction put aside.
"If he dies, don't worry," said Tuathal.
"Duke Haydn would never let Dario enter the battle."
"Ha!" said Gwynedd. "You don't know our son as well as I do. He will fight. How do you propose to protect him?"
"I can tell all our commanders not to engage any unit Dario is part of," said Tuathal, tentatively. "I'll give orders to take him alive if they somehow do engage with him."
"Will you give the same order to the southern clanland chiefs?" asked Princess Gwynedd.
"You have a point," said Tuathal.
"Vero can gate him away from the battle as soon as the clanlanders come through their gate. I'll let him know I'm adding one more thing to his list."
"You depend on Vero for so much," observed Gwynedd. "I hope he doesn't break under the strain. He's too handsome a man to waste, and he likes women."
"Don't get any ideas," said Tuathal. "He's in love with someone else. You're not in her league."
"We'll see," said Gwynedd.
She stood and motioned to Salda.
"Escort me to my tent. I have to prepare to watch a battle."
Salda started to cross to join the princess. Ursa glanced at Salda and raised an eyebrow as he passed her. He returned the same expression. Dario of Daran was King Tuathal's son. Her king was plotting with the king of Daran's mother. She had to tell Vero. Chapter 62 At the River's Edge.
"I'm ready," said Dario, as Daemon emerged from his tent. "Are you?"
"Of course, sire," said Daemon.
He extended his arms to give the shimmering fabric of his robes a chance to shake out and drape properly.
"Is it time?"
"It's nearly dawn," said the young king. "Time to earn your title."
"You can have my title," said Daemon. "I'm planning to give it up soon anyway."
Who do you have in mind for the job? Asked Dario.
There's only one suitable candidate, said Damon.
You're probably right, said Dario. But it still seems odd for a 16-year-old to start at the top.
Says the man who was king of Darren at that age, noted Damon.
You've got a point, said Dario.
The role has little to do with experience and everything to do with raw magical power, said Damon. Your grandfather handed it to me before I was 20.
Then prove his confidence in you was well-founded, said Dario. A few minutes later, Damon was on his flying disc, heading northeast toward the river with Dario holding on behind the Master Mage. They flew through thick white fog that flowed up from the riverbank, like clouds climbing up the slopes of a high mountain. A glowing ball above Damon's head didn't help Dario see further than Damon's iridescent robes in front of his nose. The old wizard seemed to know where to land, even if everything looked the same to the king in the featureless mist. Dario scraped his boots across a wide, flat rock that his companion had selected as a landing site. The king could hear and smell the river rushing by, just beyond Damon.
"Put my flying disc on my back, please," said Damon. "These robes make it harder for me to do it for myself."
"Certainly," said Dario. He took in the wizard's bent shoulders. Damon looked tired. Dario wondered if it was fair to expect a man his grandmother's age to do what he'd been asked to accomplish. He gently lowered Damon's flying disc over his shoulders by its straps. "Are you sure you're up for this?" asked Dario. He patted the flying disc, then realized the old wizard probably couldn't feel his touch through the layers of sparkling fabric in his voluminous, multicolored robe. Damon had felt it, however. He turned to face Dario.
"I know why I'm here," said the old mage. "But why are you here?"
Damon looked Dario over from his boot soles to the top of his quilted arming cap, designed to fit under his helm.
"Shouldn't you be by Duke Haydn's side, inspiring the army?"
"There's time for me to do that when we finish," said Dario. "I want to make sure you don't overextend yourself."
"I beg your pardon," Damon objected. "You asked me to freeze the Brennaven. I'm going to freeze it. Don't worry about me."
"But I do worry about you," said Dario.
"And so do I," said a soft alto voice from the fog. A woman in dark blue robes and a deep hood stepped up onto the rock. Her movements were slow and deliberate.
"Astri," said Dario, "is everything all right? Did Queen Caris send you?"
"No," said Astri. "I mean, yes, everything is fine, but your great-grandmother didn't send me. I came because of him."
"You mean Damon?" asked Dario. "I didn't even know you knew him." Damon stared at Astri like a mother recognizing her long-lost child. His eyes were wide and his mouth hung open.
"Damon and I are acquainted, Your Majesty," Astri replied after a few seconds.
She turned her body to face Damon.
"Close your mouth before you swallow too many midges," she instructed the old wizard.
Damon obeyed.
"I thought I'd never see you again," said Damon. "My heart broke when you left."
"You could have seen me any time you wanted," said Astri. "I know you have a gate from the castle in Melyncarrig to your quarters in the royal palace in Brendinas. I wasn't hiding from you."
"But the risk was too great," said Damon. "If anyone had recognized you and connected us..."
"I was 18 when I left court," said Astri. "I walked through that gate you made and into another life with you in the far west. No one would recognize the girl I was in the old woman I am."
"You're not old," protested Damon.
"Yes, I am," said Astri, as she threw back her hood.
Only a few traces of red remained in her short white hair, along with wisps of grey. Damon stepped toward her.
"Can you see now?" she said. "I wasn't protecting me. I was protecting you and our daughter."
It was Dario's turn to stare. He'd never seen Astri without her hood on. It wasn't hard to see the resemblance between the gilded statue of the young princess that stood in front of the palace and Astri's face and form.
"You're her," said Dario. "You're Princess Seren."
Astri sighed.
I once was. I fell in love with magic, and this dashing young mage.
She gestured in Damon's direction. He took two steps toward her and gave a small bow.
Being young and foolish is one thing, said Damon, but keeping it up over the years takes real talent. There's no fool like an old fool.
Damon shook his head slowly, but didn't take his eyes off Astri.
It's been 20 years since I last saw you.
And you didn't need to worry, said Astri. I kept up my masquerade and ensured my identity stayed secret. I was also there to watch over our daughter at court. My mother was glad to have my counsel as well.
Leaving me to raise our grandson on my own, said Damon. That was no way to bring up a boy.
Wait, said Dario. Who's your daughter and your grandson?
Damon and Astri weren't paying attention. Astri took a step toward Damon and reached for his hand. He took it and smiled, lines of pain and worry vanishing from his face.
That was your decision and Fircher's, said Astri. You didn't want our grandson anywhere near court.
Would you want Princess Gwyneth to guess his identity? Asked Damon.
Fircher is my aunt? Asked Dario.
Not exactly, said Damon. It's complicated.
Dario looked like he'd been smacked across the back of his head by the flat of a sword.
No, I most certainly do not want Princess Gwyneth to guess his identity, said Astri, getting back on track after Dario's interruption. That may be why I didn't fight you too hard when you were determined to keep him in exile and raise him in Melyn Carrig.
At least you kept this young fool from being the total ass he pretends to be, said Damon, indicating Dario with two fingers.
Hey, said Dario. Great-grandmother and Fircher and Duke Haydn also helped with my masquerade.
I'm grateful to them, said Damon, and to you, lad, for heeding their wise counsel. You'll be a good king, I expect.
Thank you, said Dario. I hope so.
He noticed the fog was getting brighter, even though Damon hadn't adjusted the glowing ball above his head. Fingers of red appeared to the east in the direction of the Brenhaven. Damon turned and reached the same conclusion as Dario.
Time to get busy earning my title, as you said, Your Majesty, Damon remarked.
No, said Astri, not by yourself. You weren't yet 40 when you froze the Abernoth, and it almost killed you. It took almost a year for you to recover your strength. Let me help. I'll do what I can.
Damon leaned close and hugged Astri.
We both know your best magics have nothing to do with cold, said Damon. You could barely chill wine before serving it.
Then let me lend you what energies I can, and you direct them, said Astri. Let me be your battery.
I'd rather you return to Melyn Carrig with me, so we can spend our remaining years growing old together, said Damon.
He shrugged his flying disc off his shoulders and handed it to Dario, then shifted so Astri could put her arms around him from behind and press against him.
That's perfect, said Damon. It's wonderful to feel you close again.
You're supposed to be connecting to my mage stone and its energy, said Astri.
That too, said Damon.
He looked over his shoulder at Dario.
You may want to step back, Your Majesty, he said. I don't want to turn the King of Darn into an icicle by accident.
Good idea, said Dario.
He moved to the far edge of the flat rock, keeping as much distance between himself and the wizards as possible. He held up Damon's flying disc like a shield, and saw Astri's disc a few feet from him, leaning against the edge of the rock.
It's time,
said Dario, noting the increasing light to the east. The fog was clearing, and he could now see the river flowing by, its current strong.
Lean in, said Damon.
Astri did. Damon extended his arms, faced the river, and opened a congruent connection to a place of cold. A chill wind blew out from him and swept across the river. A layer of ice formed across its surface. Damon bent over, coughing and shaking. Astri helped him back upright.
Did it work? Asked Damon.
Dario looked out across the river.
The ice coating the Brenhaven was so thin it was almost translucent. A small dog would fall through its surface, let alone a Roma legion. Then they sensed a bright flash behind them. A second later, a loud boom shattered the morning silence and some of the nearest ice on the river. All three turned and watched a huge red sphere of heat energy continue to expand, then contract in the sky not too far to the west.
"I hope that's who I think it is," said Dario.
"So do I," said Damon.
"Mary's bow from the coombe," said Astri matter-of-factly.
"A suitable candidate indeed," said the young king. "Do something to get his attention."
"As my liege commands," said Damon.
"Just do it, old man," said Dario.
"Give him a squeeze to encourage him, grandmother."
"You're not too old to be sent to your room without your supper," said Astri with a smile.
"Yes, ma'am,"
said Dario, in a contrite 5-year-old's voice. Damon launched 3 blue streamers into the sky. Chapter 63 Einan. Einan quickly realized that it was hard to keep his bearings flying through thick white fog. The glowing ball above his head didn't do much good. It just allowed him to tell the fog was cloud white, not dark grey. He couldn't see farther ahead than the fingers of his outstretched hands, and the sun was not yet up to provide a reference point. Hoping to see stars for orientation was so much wishful thinking. Einan formed a wedge-shaped shield around his body, like he had when escaping the griffins, but that only made his flight more stable. It didn't push fog out of the way, or if it did, there was more of the same fog ahead to replace it, so he dispelled the wedge.
"Now what?" thought Einan. "I can't help Damon if I can't see where I'm going."
He continued to fly in a direction he hoped was east, thinking about what to do next.
"Wait," he realized. "This is just like trying to see the Bifaland golden dragons in the clouds."
He generated the same lenses he'd created the previous morning, but they didn't help much. There wasn't anything to see except white fog. Einan still couldn't see far enough to find the river. Then he remembered how they navigated the way from Haywall Village to the milking barn when heavy fogs like thick low clouds filled the Coombs Basin. One of the villagers would tap his or her way along with a stick, and the others would trail behind, listening for the stick's scratching and the tapping of the other villagers' feet in front of them.
"That might work," Einan considered. "I could use the listening spell Mary first taught me on the Ruthro to hear the Brenhaven."
Einan worked the simple magic needed to improve his hearing. He heard running water and knew for sure which way was east. He also realized he was being tracked by 3 Tamlach wizards. They'd been keeping watch above their army's mustering field, just out of range of his limited vision.
"Blast," thought Einan.
At least the scout wizards whispered warnings to each other, noting his presence had given him a clue to their existence. The green-robed scouts had Einan boxed in. No, thought Einan, they triangulated on him. Einan knew his Euclid. 5 tendrils of force, tight light beams from the hand of the closest Tamlach wizard, cut in front of Einan's path. The fog made the beams easier to see and avoid. Einan dodged around them and accelerated. Going faster proved an unwise strategy, however. Einan had been boxed in. There were 4 green wizards, not 3. The one in front of him cast a hemisphere of solidified sound that Einan slammed into at high speed. One of the trailing wizards cast a matching hemisphere, locking Einan inside a spherical shield he didn't control. His opponents could direct the sphere's motion and send him to be inspected by the senior crown wizards at the Tamlach encampment. Einan didn't have time for that, not if Damon needed his help. He felt the heat energy pulsing in his mage stone after freezing the mudpot field, but wasn't sure where or how to release it. He didn't want to kill other wizards, even if they were from Darren's traditional opponent. He just wanted to get out of the sphere. Einan first tried to talk his way out. He waved until both wizards controlling halves of the sphere were watching. Then he shouted,
"I don't want to hurt you, so please drop the sphere and get back. I don't know how long I can control it."
Einan made sure the artifact with his red mage stone was clearly visible on his chest and willed his stone to pulse even faster and brighter. The mage stone's red light seemed to cut through the diminishing fog.
"That's a red mage stone," said one Tamlock scout mage.
"I don't like the look of it," said another.
"Maybe it controls the boy, not vice versa," said a third. "Stop scaring yourselves and squeeze that sphere,"
came a gruff, commanding voice belonging to the fourth scout. You can be sure Tuathal and Vero will want to inspect that red stone. There may be a bonus for us capturing such an unusual prisoner.
The sphere around Einan began to contract. Einan knew he could open up a congruency to outside the sphere to get more air, but it would soon be harder to move inside. He crafted a sphere of his own just inside the Tamlock wizard sphere and held it against further tightening. The third scout's observation had given him an idea.
Please, he pleaded, let me go. The mage stone is controlling me. It's angry and wants to release all its energy in one big blast. I'm trying to get to the river, so I'm the only one it will kill when it does.
Einan saw two of the scout wizards look at each other uncertainly. He increased the speed and intensity of his mage stone's pulses for emphasis, and could feel that his fabrication wasn't completely fiction. His mage stone did want to release its stored energy.
I'm fine with this spy leaving the mustering field, said one of the uncertain scout wizards. We're supposed to drive spies away, not capture or kill them, said the other.
Capturing spies is part of our job, you maggots, said the gruff-voiced wizard. She continued her insults. Any mage or mercenary with half a brain would know that.
You don't have to call us names, said the third scout wizard. Vero doesn't call us names.
When you act like sniveling, cowardly maggots, I'll call you whatever names I please, said the gruff-voiced woman wizard.
Now you sound like Tuathal, not Vero, said one of the others.
I can't hold it back much longer, said Einan. It's going to explode. I don't want your deaths on my hands as well as my own.
You're heading for the river, said one of the uncertain scout wizards. You promise?
As fast as I can get there, said Einan. Just drop your sphere and I'm gone.
It was hard for them to see Einan's face through the pulsing red energy filling the sphere.
Go then, said the wizard, who'd created the front half of the sphere.
He dispelled his creation and sped west on his flying disc, away from Einan. He was joined by the woman who'd made the other segment of the sphere. She dropped her spell once the leading hemisphere vanished and joined her departing associate. The gruff-voiced wizard didn't say anything out loud, but Einan's augmented ears could hear her mutter,
"Cowards!"
at her departing squad members' backs. She threw a pair of lightning bolts at Einan, one from each hand. Enough of the crackling energy penetrated Einan's spherical shield, designed to protect against compression, not lightning, to set the hairs on his arms and the back of his neck standing. His red maidstone pulsed still faster, and not by Einan's direction.
"Get back!" shouted Einan.
Something in his voice convinced the scout wizard who'd remained with the gruff-voiced leader to send his flying disc west after his squad mates who had disappeared into the fog. Even the squad leader moved to put more distance between herself and Einan. Partly for dramatic effect, and partly because his red magestone wanted to release its stored energy, Einan sent a ball of heat and light up and out from the stone and gold setting around his neck. He used the moderating power of his blue magestone to constrain the intensity of the release, making it more light than heat. He strengthened the sphere around him to protect himself from the coming blast. The ball detonated high above him, making the pre-dawn night brighter than noon for an instant. Heat from the explosion evaporated the fog for several hundred yards. Einan saw the gruff-voiced scout wizard, protected by a green-tinted elliptical shield, spinning end over end to the west like a grain of wheat caught by a thresher. He turned and caught a glimpse of the river. At least he'd been headed in the right direction. Then Einan saw three blue streamers of light in the sky above the Brenavon and set off at speed to find Daemon as the first hints of dawn appeared on the eastern horizon. Chapter 64 Fircher and Dothan. Fircher and Dothan flew south side by side. It made it easier for them to talk.
What's your theory? Asked Dothan.
About Vera's surprise? Asked Fircher.
No, about the fundamental nature of wizardry, said Dothan. Of course about Vera's surprise.
I think it connects to the southern clanlands, like Daemon said, Fircher replied. Vero has probably formed an alliance and arranged for them to attack Darren.
That's plausible, said Dothan. If so, Vero must have a wide gate in place somewhere north of the dormant dragon.
How far north is the question? Said Fircher. There's a lot of territory to cover in a heavy fog, even with special lenses.
I know, said Dothan, but I think we can narrow down its location. It will be as close as possible to the Darren army's encampment, while still being out of sight of our pickets and scout wizards.
That's as good a guess as any, said Fircher.
I'll change my lenses to look for mage stones.
If you spot a big rectangle, you've found it, said Dothan.
Ha, ha, Fircher replied in a monotone.
While you're looking for the gate, I'll look for the wizards Vero likely has guarding it, noted Dothan.
How far can you see through the fog? Asked Fircher.
Dothan turned his head left and right.
Maybe 50 feet, he said. You should look for mage stones too, then, said Fircher. You'll see the glow from wizard stones in this fog sooner than you'll see their faces.
True, said Dothan. He gestured to change his lenses, then slowly rotated his flying disc once around.
No other wizards nearby, he said.
Good, said Fircher, once Dothan was facing in their direction of travel again. They flew together in silence for more than a minute, scanning carefully.
Vero is clever, said Fircher. He may have more than one surprise planned.
Is he clever or crafty? Asked Dothan. Do we need to look for something sneaky or just unexpected?
The latter, said Fircher. Tuathal got a full measure of fox. Vero is more straightforward. He's a mountain lion. You know he's hunting you. He doesn't need subterfuge.
She thought back to the first time she'd seen Vero, when the young Tamlock wizard and his brother, the Crown Prince, had visited the court in Brendinas. He was tall, dark-haired, and so handsome, her breath caught when she noticed him enter the refectory that magical morning. Fircher had been thrilled when Vero had taken the seat beside her at breakfast. They discussed advanced aspects of wizardry over eggs and bacon, and had agreed to meet somewhere more private later to continue their conversation. They'd done more than talk. Barely more than a girl herself, just 12 months past her 16th birthday, Fircher remembered the fights she'd had with her father about leaving Melyn Carrig. Damon hadn't wanted her to go to court. He'd said she looked too much like her mother, and there would be questions, but she was ready to leave the confines of the academy and prove herself in the wider world. She'd cut her hair short and charged it with a tiny bolt of lightning each morning, so the only thing people noted about her appearance was her resemblance to a dandelion in seed. It had worked. None of the nobles or servants had ever said, "You look just like Princess Seren," even though Fircher was the same age as the princess when she'd disappeared.
"I have some of Damon in my face," she thought. That helped.
Nude, on the other hand, had Vero's height and colouring, but his face was a perfect match for the young king's, save for his dark hair and Dario's lack of it. His face also had a bit of Queen Caris showing through.
"That's why I didn't fight Damon over my son. If Nude had come to court, the palace and soon the whole kingdom would be buzzing," thought Fircher.
She reminded herself how much Nude and Dario resembled each other. From what Dothan had told her about Princess Gwynedd and Tuathal, the two young men were first cousins.
"It's a good thing Dario keeps his head shaved, or the resemblance would be even easier to spot."
Fircher was glad Nude was back in Melyn Carrig, working on Einan's surprise. Vero didn't know that Nude existed, and Fircher wanted to keep it that way. It had been a relief to finally tell Nude about Vero. She supposed that meant her son would seek out his father at some point, and she'd have to answer for keeping their son secret from her husband. But with luck, that wouldn't happen today.
"What are you thinking?" she asked Dothan,
to deflect attention from her own reverie. Somehow, it was easier to talk with Dothan as they flew side by side through the fog instead of facing each other across an inn table.
"This and that," said Dothan, deflecting. "You're thinking about her, aren't you? Princess Ruth."
"What if I am?" asked Dothan. "Don't remind me of our shared unrequited love for Tamlock royals." Fircher didn't think Dothan knew about the gate from her townhouse to Vero's apartment in the palace in Rias. They were friends, but she didn't know if he'd approve of her continued connection to her husband, even if it was just to share a bed from time to time.
Then again, maybe he'd be more envious than angry, she considered. "When was the last time you spoke to her?" asked Fircher.
She knew Dothan had given Princess Ruth one of his communications rings.
"More than a month ago," said Dothan, "just before the preparations for war ramped up.
I'm afraid Vero may have recognized the ring for what it was. I asked Ruth not to wear it, but she told me it reminded her of me, and she wasn't taking it off."
"She does love you," said Fircher. "That's obvious. She never married, even with dozens of suitors put before her."
"I told her to pick one," said Dothan. "I begged her not to give up her chance at a family, but she wouldn't listen."
"You're saying she's as stubborn as you are?"
I guess I am, said Dothan. Tuathal got guile, Vero got wizardry, and Ruth got...
You, said Fercher.
She nudged Dothan's flying disc so he would glance over and see her smile. I was going to say stubbornness, said Dothan. You're in much the same situation with Vero.
There's plenty of that to go around, Fercher commiserated.
An unexpected flash of red light washed over them. Dothan and Fercher spun their discs around to face north in time for their ears to be assaulted by a giant boom that echoed across the mist-covered landscape. A glowing crimson ball was expanding high above the distant horizon. Einan? Asked Dothan.
Probably, said Fercher. It resembles the one he cast above the Bifaland fleet. I hope the lad isn't hurt.
I wouldn't worry, said Dothan. With your old magestone and his red one, there's not much he can't handle.
Maybe, said Fercher. From what Mary's told me, he's far too trusting and inexperienced, like a puppy with big feet. I just hope he gets to Daemon soon enough to be useful. The old man isn't as strong as he was, but he's too stubborn to admit it. He's at another level of stubborn from the rest of us.
I can't disagree, said Dothan, and I'm glad we've turned around.
Why?
Asked Fercher. We missed Vero's wide gate when we were distracted by the fireball, Dothan replied. Look down there between those trees. It's not far south of the Darren army's encampment.
As you predicted, said Fercher.
Sometimes I hate being right, said Dothan. How many wizard's mage stones do you see?
8, said Fercher. No, 10.
Is one of them Vero? Asked Dothan.
I'm not sure, said Fercher, but I don't think so.
Good, said Dothan. Only 5-1 odds. Those aren't insurmountable. All we have to do is disrupt the gate circuit. Ready?
Fercher looked down.
From their movements, it was clear that the wizards guarding the gate had spotted them.
Ready,
she said. The upcoming confrontation didn't worry her. Fercher's larger concern did. Where was Vero?
Chapter 65. Freezing the Brenhaven.
Einan skidded his flying disc in for a landing on the broad flat rock next to the river. To his surprise, King Dario caught his arm to keep him from tipping over.
What are you doing here? Asked Einan.
Making sure our Roma allies can cross the Brenhaven, said Dario. Why are you here? I thought the rest of you were coming to the Royal Army's encampment about this time.
We were, said Einan. Then I got an idea for a way to surprise the Tamlock army, and...
Wait, lad, said Daemon. Not out here in the open. Voices carry.
Yes, sir, said Einan.
He just realized the Master Mage was standing nearby in a shimmering outfit next to an older woman wizard in heavy dark blue robes. Daemon gave Einan an exasperated look, and Einan mouthed,
Yes, Daemon, to earn a smile.
This is my... began Dario, extending an arm to indicate Astri.
Great-grandmother's personal wizard, said the woman in heavy robes. I'm Astri, and I've heard a lot about you.
Really?
Asked Einan. From whom? I have my sources, said Astri with a twinkle in her eye. We can talk about it later. Now we need to freeze a river.
Daemon stared down at the damp surface of the flat rock, not catching Einan's eye. He seemed ashamed, but Einan had never seen him express that emotion before. Dario used his arm to direct Einan's attention again, this time to the Brenhaven. Its surface was covered with a thin coating of ice, some of it cracked. Einan could see through it. He looked at Daemon, but the old wizard didn't raise his head. Astri spoke.
Daemon's not feeling well today, she said. He'd appreciate it if you'd freeze the river.
Me? Asked Einan.
Yes, young man, said Astri.
But I only know how to freeze mud, said Einan. I've never tried to freeze a river. How is it done?
Astri touched Daemon's arm. Show the lad, she said. You've always been a good teacher. You taught me.
Einan looked at the two wizards together. They seemed to be much the same age. Astri must have been one of Daemon's older students, he considered. His eyes widened when Astri took Daemon's hand and tugged him to stand at the far end of the rock. She beckoned Einan to join them. Dario followed, observing from one side. Astri lifted Daemon's head with her hand. It fell back,
She did it again, and this time, to Aylin's amazement, she kissed the Master Mage. It was a serious kiss, and Aylin turned his head, but not before he saw Dario grinning. Turning back for a quick glance, Aylin saw that Daemon had put his arms around Astri and was returning her kiss enthusiastically. Aylin focused on the river, trying to sense the structure of the ice and how it differed from liquid water. A minute later, Daemon coughed and Aylin turned back. The old wizard's posture was straighter, and his head was no longer focused on the flat rock. He had his arm around Astri and a warm smile on his face.
"Let me show you how it's done," said Daemon.
He reluctantly released Astri and faced the river. Aylin watched as Daemon extended his arms. He sensed his mentor open a congruency to a place of intense cold and use patterns of solidified sound to channel a chill wind out over the water. Aylin felt a pulse from his blue mage stone. It could help him do what Daemon had done. The ice was getting thicker. You couldn't see through it in several spots. Aylin realized the river was wider than he'd first understood. What appeared to be the far bank was actually a large island in the middle of the current. On either side of the island, Aylin could see the true far bank several hundred feet beyond. Daemon's attempt at freezing had only managed to chill a fraction of the distance.
"See?" asked Daemon. "Now you try."
"I'm confused," said Aylin. "That's not how I froze the mud pots."
"When were you back in Melin Carrig to freeze mud pots?"
"This morning," said Aylin. "It's part of my surprise for "That's not important," said Astri. "How did you freeze them?" Daemon's face was returning to its usual dyspeptic expression. Maybe Astri should kiss him again, thought Aylin. "If I interpreted your magic correctly, you're adding cold to the water," said Aylin. "That only works slowly, from the top down, and the layer of ice at the top insulates the flowing water below."
"What do you propose?" asked Daemon.
He removed his arm from Astri's shoulder, then crossed both of his over his chest. Dario was leaning forward, watching closely.
"Instead of adding cold, why not take away heat?" asked Aylin. "That's what I did with the mud pots, and they were hot to begin with."
"I'm not sure what you mean," said Daemon.
He rested his chin on one palm and put his other arm back around Astri. Dario saw that Astri had been rubbing the small of Daemon's back.
"I'll show you," said Aylin.
He adjusted his red mage stone and centered its setting on his breastbone over his jacket. Then he extended his arms and threw out two huge transparent walls of solidified sound, 500 feet up and down the river from bank to bank, with a large island in the middle. The current stopped flowing. Aylin's blue mage stone took over control of the walls, leaving Aylin and his red mage stone free to absorb the water's heat. Aylin took a deep breath. As he drew in air, he also drew in every calorie of warmth from the top 2 feet of water between the transparent walls. A layer of ice, thicker than a barn's foundation stones, snapped into place from shore to shore and more, drawing high up the river's banks to anchor it firmly in place. The young wizard fell backward like a toppled tree. Only Dario's quick-thinking assistance saved Aylin from hitting his head on the ground. The walls of solidified sound disappeared with a pair of pops. Beneath the sturdy sheet of ice, the river began to flow again, with only a brief interruption. Dario carefully placed Aylin's limp body on the grassy bank. Astri used her hood to pad Aylin's head. She listened to the young wizard's shallow breathing and felt his forehead. It was burning hot. Astri moved to sit behind the top of Aylin's head and put her hands on his temples. The others stood by, watching as she attempted to heal him. Her efforts appeared to be working. Slowly, his breathing returned to normal, but his temperature was still too high.
"Should we drag him out on the ice to cool him off?" asked Dario.
"What?" asked Aylin, jerking his head up and away from Astri's soothing palms.
"No, not ice,"
he said before his head fell back.
"Rest," she told Aylin. "That was amazing. A tremendous feat of wizardry. Channel your body's heat to your mage stone."
Aylin nodded weakly. He felt physically drained by his effort, but Astri's healing touch was making a difference. Still, his red mage stone was pulsing rapidly, sending out rhythmic flashes of crimson.
He looked down and saw his stone seemed 10 or even 100 times as full of energy as it had after he'd chilled a crust over the mud pots. The stretch